Welcome to The Weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Chris.
And this week on The Weekly, Wizards of the Coast ignores original creators. No surprise. Modiphius strangely announces a new game.
Okay.
Warzone Eternal Kickstarter has a date.
Ooh, nice.
And Cthulhu hits Japan.
Okay.
So let's get started with the, the first thing, this is, was a story. It came from a Facebook conversation, but it was a story that was on Bounding Into Comics.
Okay.
And they're a bit of a shit stir website.
Okay.
They like to kind of make things worse.
Okay.
sometimes. So they posted a kind of back and forth that happened. So the Dragonlance and Spelljammer creators say they had no involvement with the new Dungeons and Dragons products based on their work.
Okay.
So in a recent announcement, they said that both Dragonlance and Spelljammer will be returning. Spelljammer got a lot more detail in the Dungeons & Dragons Direct announcement that happened on the 21st, on April 21st. And there was a nice kind of announcement of the Shadow of the Dragon Queen will be the first adventure book for Dragonlance.
Okay.
And Warriors of Kryn will be the battle game. So they're going to do, by the end of this year, they said, both a battle game and I guess they're really getting into battle games.
And they specifically called it a battle game.
Yes, yes. So
I wonder what a battle game is.
I don't know. I guess that's just fight a bunch of stuff. It's just combat.
That's what D&D is anyway. So
right, just combat. Yeah, yeah, right.
I wonder what form, it's going to be like a board game or like a miniatures game, or are we going to like do like a Pokemon battle with cards or something?
Yeah, I wonder. Well, they did, was it with 4th edition? They were releasing those board games that were basically like strip out the role play and just all the character stats and everything are the
same.
So
you mean the role playing game?
Yeah, the role playing game.
So strip out the role playing game, and it was the role playing game. Wah, wah. No, sorry. Okay. I've kind of come around a little bit on 4th edition. But no, I know what you mean. It was like Shards of Avalon. No, it's not Shards of Avalon. There was some kind of Shards of something, a Ravenloft based where it was a board game
with, as you said, kind of a tile crawling kind of board game.
Mm-hmm. And I never played one, but from what I hear, they were decent. They were okay.
Yeah, and it seemed like a good gateway to like kind of get what combat and dungeon crawling is going to be like, and then also familiarize yourself with like the stat lines and everything.
You know, actually, having played Descent. I had a blast playing Descent. I ran it, and there was role play, and it was almost kind of like the two things are so separated, they kind of work, right? Because the mechanics are all just taken care of, and we don't have to try and integrate them into any kind of story, and so we're free to narrate whatever we want is going on, and it actually kind of worked. So if it's that kind of battle game, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see. Yeah, they're getting. I think it's the Hasbro influence. They're kind of heavily getting into a board game for everything, and also so there was a reintroduction. So Spelljammer is being reintroduced for 5e. We saw the announcement of a kind of a box set for that, and so kind of based on the second edition incarnation with the same name. These are the same name, Adventures in Space.
Okay.
So what happened on Facebook is Jeff Grubb, the writer who originally wrote Spelljammer for second edition, posted on Facebook, yes, Wizards of the Coast is bringing the Spelljammer setting into 5e. No one talked to me about it. Then he added, I'm as surprised as you are. And then this was noticed, of course, by Weiss, who just replied also said, and Wizards of the Coast is bringing a Dragonlance game book, and they didn't talk to me or Tracy on that. And then the response to that, so here's the thing. I'm pretty cool with people. Oh, this is Grub again.
Right.
I'm pretty cool with people moving concepts that I worked on forward, but a little more than irritated that Margaret doesn't get a heads up, given that she and Trace have new works that they're putting together for the world. Me, I'm nostalgia. They are in there pitching. And the response was, thanks, Jeff. And at least I have plausible deniability. So ultimately, yeah, joking about it. But that's it's funny. It's like if they're going to celebrate these settings and things, you think you want just a few words. It's like you know, if it was work for hire, he doesn't own any of that IP, then at least, you know, include just some comments on this announcement, or like a little interview or something, not even part of that direct, but something kind of reconnecting, like what were the origins and how did this come together to inspire people to look at this new version, you know, maybe that had experience with the previous, or kind of get a context, like a more of a how this in the development of D&D, how this fit. But they heard it the same way we heard it on this D&D direct announcement. So
I retweeted that because I saw that. And there was discussion about, WotC is kind of doing what they always do. But I guess from, not a business standpoint, but like in all truth, fair, I don't know. But in all truth, I don't know how or what contract Grubbs and Weiss and Hickman had when they produced those works for WotC or Hasbro or TSR, whatever it was at the time.
Right.
If it was, as you said, work for hire or like spec work, then it's like, you don't own it anymore. You created it. You're allowed to say you were the creator, unless you pull like a Musk and then like buy something. So, you know, someone buys you and they get to say they were the creator. But realistically, WotC and Hasbro might not have any responsibility to contact them, right?
No.
It's theirs. I mean, I'm not exactly going to say like it's a dick move, but as you said, there's kind of no responsibility for them to do it other than being nice, possibly. So,
who knows? It might not fit in with their whole marketing strategy or whatever. You know, they don't want to show older people when they're marketing to a younger audience or whatever they're doing. But it is a little tasteless. And it reminds me of the thing that I was kind of disgusted by on the animation that I've seen up on the Warhammer Plus service. There's no credits for anything for anybody.
Of course not. It's owned by GW now.
Yeah, they give you a studio name and written by Storyforge. Like there was a human being or a group of, you know, a writer's room or whatever, however they're doing it. Probably just a guy, you know, being paid contract. But they don't credit anything. I think the composer for the music is credited. But are we going back to like to the 1930s where it was just like the company, like everything that's produced for a company, like the actual creatives are invisible and it's just the, you know, the company's name produced by, written by, just a company name. So this smacked a little bit of that.
Okay. Yeah, I see that.
Yeah, is that they're just like trying to like, well, let's not, you know, we don't even talk about, maybe in the book they are going to credit original concept by or whatever in these source books. But whatever, it just was a little like we're gonna do that. That's kind of a crappy thing. And to get their input or just a few words on, you know, what their inspirations were would have been nice for context. And of course, this reminds us of last year the lawsuit.
Yeah,
the lawsuit that was settled out of court for the new Dragonlance novels that were. I guess there was a contract for them. They were written and they were getting revisions and then the revision stopped and then there was no more talk anything.
Did we ever find out what happened with that? Because
They settled out of court an amount.
Yep.
And so it's an undisclosed, undisclosed amount.
Wasn't there, am I misremembering that there was kind of talk about stuff being not like sensitive enough? Or not being kind
of... I think so. Yeah, like, there was some editor or something that they had. Yeah, there was. They brought up someone's name that was supposed to be kind of shepherding this project. And I think that may have been... That communication is maybe where it fell apart. And so...
That's in the case of like Dragonlance. Because,
yes.
So who knows what's happening or what happened with Weiss and Hickman. And maybe WotC went, no, we don't want... kind of anything with them anymore. Like we're done.
And well, the new series of novels is going through.
Oh, really?
Yes, okay. Yes, yes. Okay. So they settled out of court for this contract and it's all happening, but it's just the novels. And so they didn't involve them in the source book. So they were surprised. Oh, game book is coming out. Well, we're still working on like, so they have a continuity, maybe those notes, maybe the designers of that book have those notes or whatever. So they can include any, you know,
maybe, but
stuff.
Again, I don't know what, this is all speculation. I don't know what contract they worked under. Mm-hmm. So it's possible like Weiss and Hickman might not own Dragonlance anymore. It'd be like, you know, for all I know, WotC is saying, yes, you're allowed to write this novel.
Mm-hmm.
The IP is ours now. Right. So it's kind of like, even though you created ours.
Yeah. Cause
you're getting the privilege of, you're paying for the privilege of writing in this thing.
Yeah. Where, Yeah.
We don't have to really consult you on anything. It's ours.
Yeah, because we don't know what those terms were of the settlement. Yep. It may have been a big enough amount of money, and those could have been the terms. Yeah, we own it. You can continue to develop it, but you know, we can say yes or no about anything. Right. And I think under the kind of current WotC's like weird image of what they want to do, I think that might be very uncomfortable to try to be creative, you know, under those
I imagine so.
Under those restraints. So, yeah, so we'll see. So that was just a funny little kind of shit-stirring thing that I saw that somebody was talking about the Facebook conversation, and just, can we just stop doing this? And if the people of the wrong color or whatever, you know, for what D&D has their image of. I mean, it's a woman fantasy author. So why is that a problem? You know, so I don't understand. Like, there is some kind of obvious thinking there from the marketing department, I do believe. Because why wouldn't you talk to the creators? But anyhow, let's move on to something even more bizarre. So the live stream that was the Dungeons & Dragons Direct announcement where all this stuff was included was... There was another live stream happening at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Another announcement live stream from Modiphius.
Oh, okay.
And if you tuned into this live stream, you saw like a stone, maybe dungeon wall with sconces with torches.
Yeah.
And light kind of flickered a little bit, and it went on and on and on, and at like minute 59,
wow, okay,
the wall crumbles, and then they show the title of this new property, and then they show a couple of quick like 1 minute trailers. So you wait almost an hour to see like 2 minutes of like teaser announcements for a new property.
Okay.
And I think they did that because they knew they couldn't compete, you know, compete for attention, compete for views, and they might just, out of curiosity, pull people away from the live, because all of the stuff gets archived, so you can watch it on demand anyhow. But they might pull some people away, go, what is this? So the enigmatic style of, I just thought it was weird and confusing. And then once it was in the archive, all the comments are, well, I'm glad I didn't watch this live. And I'm glad, you know, I'm glad I just could just like scrub to the end to see what the hell this was. Because it's just an announcement and just a wall. And so I guess, you know, that avant-garde guerrilla marketing, I guess, you know, if you're not big, then be confusing is the their motto. But we did get an announcement for a new game, which is going to be kind of a couple of things, and it called Kohor's Cthulhu.
Oh,
right. And a little bit of text on that is, where once mighty legions marched and valiant tribes fought, where legends walked lands and terrors prowled the vast forests, where ancient secrets unlocked immense power and inhuman gods threatened chaos and destruction. .. So that's on the website. That's their little introductory of it. So this is actually part of a bigger IP, kind of their original IP
right.
that Modiphius first had called Against the Gods Themselves, which is an Elder Gods kind of thing. And that's where the Octon Cthulhu setting comes from.
That's the one I'm familiar with.
Right. So this is all the same universe of Elder Gods, kind of, you know, historical Elder Gods, you know, weird history with Eldritch horror. And so it's the same universe. And this, the Kohor's Cthulhu, is going to be a narrative, cooperative, war game, fiction line, and set of miniatures. So I was, not only is it a TTRPG.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so it's a TTRPG, 2D20 system, also a war game, also a setting with novels, and also miniatures, a line of miniatures.
Okay.
So that's a lot. That's a lot to produce. Yeah. And I think, you know, maybe after their experience with Mutant Chronicles and some licensed IPs, maybe this feels nice to return to their origins and develop another kind of, you know, thing that's all of theirs and a game and a setting.
Or maybe they say, we can't pay for more IPs.
Yeah, right. We can't afford. It's too expensive.
Yep.
And so miniatures will be produced. So it will be gladiators, centurions, and Germanic heroes. And all happening around the time of the Roman Empire, as it's slowly, I guess, the collapse of the empire. Okay. And so the kind of an all-star, there's a lot of recognizable people working on it. So, of course, Chris Birch is the creative head. Douglas Seacat, who worked on War Machine Hordes and Iron Kingdoms RPG, is one of the writers. The RPG lead is Matt Goetz, who's also a Kingdoms, a Pathfinder D&D 4th edition writer. John Houlihan, who worked on Actun Cthulhu, Mundu Cthulhu, and the Seraph Chronicles, is also one of the writers. So they've got a few writers that have been previously involved in things. Nick Brown is their 2D20 developer. Nick Brown is the writer. Nathan Dowdle is the 2D20 coordinator. So he worked on Star Trek and Dune and Fallout. And then some artists that have worked on other previous properties. Bjorn Barons worked on John Carter and is also from Marvel Comics. And then Farallone Gardner, who's worked on Conan, Diablo, League of Legends. Wow, a lot of video game talent. So this is kind of a group, working on this original IP for them. So later this year, no release date so far, later this year. And so real history, real locations, and real cultures with a touch of Lovecraft in there. So, they're really emphasizing this kind of a cooperative thing. So they talk about powerful magics, ancient lost technologies, and eldritch powers will all be involved in this system. And, of course, you're fighting against the ever-growing threat of the Outer Gods, as they're terming
them. Not Elder Gods.
And in the Roman Empire, in other parts of the Roman Empire, like Britannia, Aegyptus, Byzantine, and the Eternal City of Rome herself will be featured. Yes, so, this is interesting. It was a big announcement, and there's a lot of kind of alternative, I guess it's a lot of Napoleonic, like alternative Napoleonic things going on kind of indie right now. So this is a funky time for this because there already are a couple of systems for doing either 28 or smaller scale Roman Empire.
I was thinking that too. But do you think do you think it's a weird time to do that, or do you think it's a decent kind of time to do that? Because, not that I want to play 28 millimeter or any kind of actual historic war game, but just from buying those historic miniatures to play for other stuff, I've started looking at other systems, and 28 millimeter kind of Roman Empire, whatever that time period is called, does seem popular. Like there are several companies that produce miniatures of that time period.
Right.
My thought is, okay, they're going to do their own, Modiphius is going to do their own line of miniatures. But if there are already a lot of other miniatures, not that you don't need to, because why not get people to just buy something all at one time? But that also gives people the option to use other miniatures, right? So I kind of think, only hearing this, it doesn't seem like that bad of an idea, right? Because if other miniatures already exist, people can go like, I like these, I've already bought these. There's a new game I can play with them, right? Or I'm just getting into it. I can buy everything from Modiphius and save on shipping. Okay, sure. Why not? Then I can expand it with these other ones. So I don't know. I don't think it's a terrible idea.
Yeah, and from the trailer, they showed Roman legionnaires and things being corrupted by tentacles and stuff. So there may be some kind of creative, just like with the Actun Cthulhu, there's some fun kind of miniatures, fun kind of mashup of miniatures and the way that, cultists and things look in the 40s. So, this may be that same sort of thing where it's a little bit different than things you've seen before, and it's for an original IP. So maybe if they're getting authors and things to develop for it, maybe it'll have an interesting enough lore that it'll drag players into it, and it's theirs. Like Modiphius owns it, so that's the great thing about it, is they're not going to lose this license. So a quote from Chris Birch said, working on this project has let us massively expand the universe, and that we've delved deeply into the mystical ancient records of the Hyperboreans and the strange technologies of Atlantis on the road to the mighty empire. So in the Shadows of Atlantis campaign for Actun Cthulhu, we teased a connection to Atlantis. And in the Mountains of Madness, we promised an epic sequel that showed what would happen if at the end of World War II, if the Nazis finally woke the sleeping gods. We have always planned to build this world out, and now we can. So, yes, the Outer Gods will now be dealing with ancient Rome and Germania and all sorts of...
I don't know. Just personal feeling here. I would almost not want to see Atlanta. Not Atlanta.
I don't want to see Atlanta. Yeah, I don't want to.
Okay, sorry.
It's hot.
yeah. Okay. I can look at it, but I just want to be there, right? So, like Atlantis, right? Mm-hmm. Because just by like, I don't want to play in any kind, in a historical setting. But my kind of thought is, if you're going to do a historical setting, then you kind of got to do a historical setting. And just by adding like Cthulhu or Outer Gods, we've mm-hmm. already. Or they've already made it their own thing, and you. Mm. But my, and it'd be a fine line, kind of one of those things. Like, okay, I'd know it when I see it. If you push too far into fantasy, I feel like you've kind of done fantasy,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I couldn't tell you what that line is, but just okay, it's Roman Empire with a few of these imaginary cults. Mm-hmm. That to me sounded interesting. As soon as you went. And possibly there's going to be Atlantis with possibly weird tech. I kind of went, it's that's a bit too fantastical for my taste. And that's just me personal. But anyway. So.
Yeah, and I guess they have to kind of theme. They'll have what technology, what factions are using. So each faction is going to have its own flavor. And if you're like, oh, that's a weird combination. Yeah, it may turn some people off or may be difficult to find exactly what you want to play. It's like, okay, well, I don't want to play, magical electric Rome, so okay, what, yeah.
Anyway, my thought, what was I thinking about? I almost thought, this is not Cthulhu, right? Even though one of the things is called Octon Cthulhu, this is their own IP, probably based on H.P. Lovecraft stuff. Right. Very appropriate shirt, I like it.
Mm.
Cthulhu to me was always kind of more investigatory.
Yes.
And I have not played Octon Cthulhu. Mm-hmm. I probably would not. But I always got the impression you could do more of a spy game.
Right. Yeah.
Right? It's more like, the Nazis are trying to do this thing. We got to go stop them. And it's not going to be two big armies clashing or a tabletop thing. Mm. So I was almost expecting Cohorts Cthulhu or whatever it's called to be more investigatory.
Mm.
Right? And maybe it would have to be on your own side, right? Because, they're having watched a couple very shows, right? Like that Barbarians on there, right? Like, people like the Roman Empire seemed pretty cosmopolitan. So it could potentially have been a game where you need to infiltrate, right? Different groups or different ethics or different organizations in order to try and find the influence of these outer gods, whatever.
Right.
But if you go in like a big, and they didn't say war game, but a big kind of like skirmish game, that's kind of like, they're the cultists. Let's go fight, right?
Mm.
So, hey, maybe it's going to be cool.
Mm.
Maybe you will be able to do investigation. That's what I would be kind of more interested in.
Yeah. Sorry. I hope I'm not confusing. The announcement is kind of, and they're a little bit confusing too with mentioning all this stuff at the same time. But just like Octon Cthulhu, and I think the miniatures game was first with that, and then the RPG came. I'm getting confused because there's a newer version of the RPG.
Right.
But it is both an RPG and a miniatures game, so you can use the miniatures in the RPG. And I think this is going to be a similar thing. Because they're kind of vague and mysterious about what you're going to be doing because they want the novels and the setting to come out.
It's a role playing game. You can do anything you want, right? You can use the system to do anything, even if it's not play Cthulhu in Roman era. Yeah,
anything that 2D20 will allow.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to see another kind of iteration of 2D20 and how how they're advancing that, like what they're naming all the points and things. Then. But if they come up with an interesting dynamic or some kind of corruption or madness, currency that might be
not having played Octon or even looked at Octon Cthulhu, we're going to have the discussion of sanity again, right? Like, I think we've kind of moved. My feeling is we've kind of moved on from that, even though the original Call of Cthulhu game hasn't, but. I don't know if that's something you want to include, and because that's a sensitive topic, you're going to have to address it with sensitivity. And the first thing you said we're going to have like the different areas, and like as soon as you said real world cultures, I kind of went, great, you're going to need sensitivity readers for that as well.
That's all Europe. Fuck them.
Yeah. Well, I originally went like, all right, I'll do it. Then I went, nope, the Roman Empire was huge, right?
Right.
Like the Roman Empire encompassed A lot.
I guess, we are talking North Africa and stuff.
Yep. So that you're going to have to do that unless you, and you would still need sensitivity readers. Like, that is the one of the, I guess, pros of fantasizing stuff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
But then again, you're either historical with a little bit of fantasy, or your fantasy that's kind of loosely based on history, right?
Right,
I'm thinking of like the Conan stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like the whole reason Conan was set in the Hyborian Age is because Robert E. Howard went, love writing historical fiction. I'm a commercial writer. I can't spend the amount of time it takes for me to research, so I'm going to fantasize all of this stuff and call it the Hyborian Age, and it kind of allowed him to do both. But
anyway. Yeah, we'll return to the madness mechanic in the last announcement we have. But and I guess if I would have organized this better, I could have segued right into it. But we have a date.
We do. Where are we going?
I worked.
calendar. Yes. Right. Okay.
We worked so hard, to draw this out. I used all of my interviewing skill to try to pull this out of Alex Knaus from Resnova Games when I talked to him about this upcoming Warzone Eternal. So we're talking about the date for Warzone Eternal. The Kickstarter now has a date. They promised spring, and they just got it. I think technically it's a few days still, like the beginning of May. Technically, it's still spring, right? So they didn't lie, but yeah, we have a date of May 17th will be the launch. So yeah, we'll be clear. I think this season is very difficult because they're clear of Chronopia, but they're not going to be clear of Blade Runner and some other things that are coming.
Well,
so May is going to be a busy Kickstarter month.
Sure, my thought is like if you're trying to wait until you're like absolutely clear of everything, you'll be waiting forever.
Mm-hmm. Right? Oh yeah, because Kickstarters keep coming. Yes, but it was great. So take a look at that interview. I'll put a link to to our conversation, and Alex was really upfront with everything that they're doing, and we got the reveal of the COCast that they're using for the miniatures.
When are we getting the demo of that to play test?
Oh, I wish. Yeah, they're not doing demo boxes. Oh, well. But there will be. Brian C.P. Steele had a post on the Facebook group for Warzone Eternal that was open to questions, and he just said, post questions, I'm not going to answer them, and they're going to do a big AMA. So I think either prior to the launch or at the beginning of the launch of the Kickstarter, every question that everybody has been dying to ask, they're going to kind of combine together and do a big AMA for the launch of Warzone
Eternal. Except for the questions that start, this is really more of a comment.
Yeah, right.
Those get just tossed right in the fucking trash. Like, don't do that. Don't do that.
Yeah, so it's a really active Facebook group too, so I'll put a link to that as well. And then also the Kickstarter announcement page where you can kind of save it and get notified when it launches. So I'm curious to see the art that they've been showing has been interesting. I'm really curious to see how this how they're going to structure this campaign because we've already seen now Chronopia do this, and for Chronopia, the initial setup didn't work for a lot of people. It was just confusing. They didn't understand how much work you could do in the pledge manager afterwards. So you just kind of pledge a level that you want, and then you can add things.
Yeah.
And that was, they had to kind of start to explain that as the campaign continued because people were full of questions. So that'll be the thing that we'll see here. It seems like because it's all corp versus corp soldiers that we may get like a base torso that you then, you know, put different shoulder pads and things on, because it's going to be, you know, kits. And so we'll see if they have an easier time of just saying, here, buy an infantry box, and then, you know, then this is your Bauhaus, or this is your
interesting
whatever. Yeah, so I'm not sure how they're going to do it, because we've seen things that it looked like originally they were on sprue, but we know from COCast that it's just going to come as individual pieces, like resin, but it's not resin.
I wouldn't want to see that.
Mm.
Because I'm remembering, and again, I didn't have that many, but I did have this box, and I remember the Bauhaus, you know, troopers. They all had a pretty distinct look from one another. Mm-hmm. And if you went, here's a corp infantry box.
Yeah,
no, because like they're like, apart from painting them different colors, how are you going to differentiate them, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you kind of go with the kind of classic style of all the different corps, they look different enough from each other where I don't think you could have an infantry.
Yeah,
box,
there's
right?
so, there's so many
that went
units,
across everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you could maybe go, here's like the capital infantry box, and here's the, and have different pieces to assemble different things, and here's the Maishima infantry box, which again, all of Asia would not just team up. Everyone fucking hates Japan. That would not happen, right?
Well, China was decimated by nuclear fallout. So.
Still, wouldn't happen. Wouldn't happen, right? You would, no. Like, we would have it, like, we probably potentially have it, like, an everybody but Japan kind of corp, but whatever. So, I hope they do corp-themed boxes
They'll have to for certain units, definitely. But, yeah, it seemed like from just, I think they showed, like, a blood beret or something, and it did seem like some of the pieces were, and maybe that just will help with production or whatever, but the parts were just kind of basic, and then they became customized by the, you know, heads and arms and everything. So what do you prefer? Because Chronopia went with an almost totally like monopose style. There wasn't like you're not choosing weapons. Yep. Like a unit has these specific weapons, and the poses were very dynamic, you know, compared to kind of the static illustrations, like the representations in the books for the different units. But what would you prefer? Like something like an old Warhammer where you can, you know, have multiple head choices and multiple arm choices, or kind of a monopose, a really dynamic, interesting monopose, but then you don't have any choice of like loadout, basically. Right.
Well, kind of depends on how the game plays. We played just the Hero Skirmish of Chronopia, but looking at the cards, it's like, okay, there's Hero Skirmish, then there's, I forget what the next level up is. There's like three tiers where you can play. One where you have like five-ish figures, one where you have like maybe like 20-ish.
Right, right.
And you have arranged them into like units.
And coherence then becomes a thing.
Yeah. And then you have the big battles, right? So, and looking at the cost, right? It's like, okay, it's this much for a single figure in Hero Skirmish. It's this much and you get these options for this many figures or this many models in the unit when you're doing the patrol, I think.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. Right?
And then it was like this much for this figure, this many figures, or this much more for a full unit, and these options, right? So I almost kind of, not almost, I did like the, I'm just going to pick this unit. And the contents of the unit, game-wise, are pretty set. And that would lead me to wanting monopose stuff, right? Because I don't have to worry about loadout. Then if you go to something like my last remembrance of 40K, where it's like, okay, you get this many in the squad, and you can pay plus 10 points for a fusion gun, or plus 10 points, and you can kit the squad out.
Right.
And part of the fun is building that squad. Well, then you're going to need multi-part stuff.
Right.
So I don't know how Warzone Eternal would work if it's sort of the simpler, more streamlined, pick these units.
Yeah, if you're not going to be
monopose. Right. If it's a page of options and you really got to build the squad, then we need the multi-part one. So
yeah,
both have pros and cons.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what they do. And once they went to plastic, like with second edition, I think it was still pretty monopose. There wasn't like,
well, but you know, it was monopose. But if I remember this box, like it was a pain in the ass to glue like the guns onto the Bauhaus troopers, because it was just like a ball joint for the elbow, ball joint for the elbow.
Right.
And you could kind of pose them like that. And that was enough to get variation the unit. Those ball joints fucking sucked, right?
Right.
But then you had a few like heavy weapon soldiers in there. So that was enough. That was okay.
To give you variety. Yep. Yeah, yeah.
I'm wondering how Chronopia will look when there's like only two versions of the basic trooper and you have a unit of like eight.
It might
look a little boring.
They upped the unit. The unit size, I believe it's almost five now. I think it's up
like
to
5 or 6.
Yeah, yeah. But they do have alternate sculpts as well. So I was really happy to see Chronopia did that. So yeah, we'll see what Warzone Eternal is going to do to handle that. Because I think, you know, a big part of the enjoyment of this is the hobby aspect of it and making your army, you know, look unique or look exactly how you want it to. So we'll see. Yeah, how that gets handled for Warzone Eternal. Yeah, I can't wait to kind of compare these two approaches because they're similar enough games, you know, produced by the same company. So these are going to be two very different systems. They're going to approach the miniatures and everything differently. So I'm very excited to see how they handle that. And hope good luck to the Warzone. They get a lot of activity on their Facebook group. So hopefully they have a big first day, first hour, first 10 minutes.
Funded in 5 seconds, yeah.
And we don't know their the budget, the goal, and everything yet, too. Their goal might be big, but we'll see. And they already said, though, that in the interview, Alex said, you know, we're starting out small, similar to how First Edition started out, where there were things in the book there wasn't even models yet for, we're growing and we're going to kind of grow into this. And so as people get behind this game and start supporting it, of course, then the range will
grow,
expand. Yep. So, yeah, we'll see. And all those exciting stretch goals and all that good stuff. So, we'll really get a better idea. And I think more than Chronopia, Warzone Eternal has been playing it a lot closer to the vest as far as like how this campaign's going to come out and everything. So it finally launching is going to give us a lot of information and hopefully get people excited instead of make people confused. So we'll see. All right. So we'll try to maintain our sanity. So this 2022 is becoming an expensive year. Chronopia, Warzone Eternal, and then we got Plastic Horus Heresy coming out maybe by the end of the year. So it's just
that's like beyond expensive.
expensive year. All right. And finally, some Japanese news. So this was a notification I got in Japanese, and I was like, oh, this is probably worth talking about. Back to Cthulhu. So it was just announced that a Swedish TTRPG called Cthulhu is being released in Japanese.
Oh, cool.
And it's like, well, that's weird because I couldn't find it. I couldn't find an English language release. I found it on DriveThruRPG in the original Swedish. But there may be an English release that I just, you know, was too Google handicapped to be able to find. I don't know what my my Google abilities may have failed. But this is a game that was produced in Sweden in 2017 by Mikael Bergström. And it is a great take on Cthulhu because, like you were saying, it's very investigation heavy. Okay. They said basically it's like Agatha Christie inspired, like mystery and investigation. Mm. And it's a, as you would say in Swedish, sexidiga. Tannigar, the six-sided dice system. So six-sided die, and I never knew what the word for dice was in Swedish. I think probably a 2d6. Looking from the stats, it looks like a 2d6. So very similar to the range of a Powered by the Apocalypse kind of scale. And the way you build the character is very interesting. It relies on, you know, kind of their profession. It's very heavy into their profession and what that gives you. And why would they release this in Japan? Well, because Call of Cthulhu is the most popular role-playing game here. Yep. And to give them...
That's why! Okay, world most popular. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Not in Japan.
Right.
Most popular RPG in Japan is Call of Cthulhu.
Right. And so that means that there's years and years of adventures and things developed for this. So having another system that was in Japanese that you could very easily play instead of the kind of basic role play based, you know, percentile dive based system, to have something that's very light and easy, just a D6 system, is a good idea. I mean, I think whoever kind of came up with this idea for the release, and it's actually being released by Vivian, and digital only, so currently. So there's no, you can order the Swedish language hardbound from various like international booksellers, but for right now we're getting a digital release, and they said that they're going to follow up with other other books from this same system. But the thing that really stood out to me was their kind of madness mechanic, and they do strictly kind of say that they're trying to go back to something that is really true to kind of the literary inspiration, as opposed to just having like a second health system or something where it's just like you're losing your mind and your blood, you know. It's
and when it hits zero, you suddenly become a kleptomaniac.
Sure, that's and so the really interesting aspect of this, and they kind of flesh it out in the, so I downloaded it's a pay what you want PDF for the Swedish version. So I downloaded it, and you know, Swedish translate pretty computer friendly translates to English, so you get a good
idea.
Yeah, the good idea of what they're talking about. And so from the description in the book of the hallucinations, or kind of like a, you know, what happens is when a character has experienced something their brain denies, it is appropriate that they are primarily affected by strange dreams. And then their brain process. So they basically break this up into there are stages that the character is in, kind of like almost stages of mourning, like you know, acceptance and denial and kind of
like the seven stages of grief or something.
Like grief. Yeah. So like a bargaining and things. And so, yeah. So denial, fumbling, groping, acceptance, and adaptation. And what happens during these various phases is not you suddenly develop some kind of, you know, psychological disorder or whatever, is that you are seeing things. You're having either visions or things are coming to you in your dreams, or you're starting to see combinations of things either as phantasms, or they also call them chimera, and things. And they're all related to the mystery that you're... so it's a way, and I think it's... You know, if you're applying this to older material, it might take some work on the Game Master's part. But it sounds like a really interesting way to be feeding information and also keeping the characters very kind of off their kind of unsure of themselves by what they're actually did I see that, or did I think I saw that, or what is actually happening, and what is this information that I'm getting, and does this really, you know, pertain to what's
I'm going to want to read that, because I'm kind of interested in games where the character, the player character, is sort of an unreliable narrator, right? Because normally in other role-playing games, right, the GM has to act as the player character senses, and generally speaking, that is supposed to be reliable information. What can my character see, hear, smell, touch, taste, right? You got to give me that information, and you kind of got to be honest, at least, you know, honest information based on what my character has access to. But in Call of Cthulhu style games, the character then becomes unreliable because of all the weird shit they're encountering, right?
Right.
And we as players do, okay, it would be much less interesting if the player was able to go, that's real, that's a hallucination, that's real, right? Like, what if they can sift out what they can trust and what they can't, that becomes kind of boring. I want to know if it's just I the player have no idea what's actually true and what's not. Is there something mechanical there to help that experience? Or because you don't necessarily need one. My feeling is, just like the fear mechanics in Alien, it helps reinforce, right? Kind of encourages. Sometimes you want that taken off your hands, right? You don't want to metagame the, okay, I as a player know this, but my player knows it's false. Sometimes you second guess yourself about how you would act if you're trying to portray this. So sometimes the mechanical, I have no control over what's going on. Sometimes I like how that frees you up from the worry of metagaming.
No, that's true. And then the explanation continues. So the increasingly accurate and clear descriptions the players receive of the mythical world phenomena escalate simultaneously with the increasingly distorted descriptions they receive of other parts of reality. So I really liked, and they seem to spell it out very clearly by what things are connected to what. There's some really interesting charts that are kind of inspirational for how you would balance these things and when certain things would happen and how, you know, unreliable information becomes, or how deeply they start to see into another kind of world. So that was an interesting approach. And so the combination of things is, oh, something is coming to Japan that I don't think has come to other parts of the world. It's Cthulhu-based, and they're taking a totally different approach. It's got a really nice, elegant character sheet, which is, you know, very similar to Powered by the Apocalypse looking, and just a big emphasis on what training the characters have and what tools they're going to use. And there was a really great... description of, it's not the dice rolls that affect the player's success or ability to decode their mystery. It's their intelligence. So it's puzzle solving. It's puzzle solving and putting together clues in a mystery, and not just all based on, I'll give you clue number three now because you got over 12.
Now I'm even kind of more interested, but also slightly less interested because the extreme opposite end of the I roll for a clue, I roll to figure it out. To me, the extreme opposite end of that is, I as the player am smart. I as the player can figure this out. I as the player am doing nothing through the lens of my character. Why do I even have a sheet in front of me?
Right. I see.
Like, there's got to be a middle between that, right? Like, we talk a lot about, like, okay, the talky person can't talk their way past the guards when they're playing the Charisma 3 Barbarian, right? And like, where's the line between that, right? So you don't want, it's Yeah. On one side, only the die roll matters, and that's kind of boring. On the other side, only the player's skill kind of matters, and that's kind of boring. So,
right.
in my opinion.
And I think the role, like your profession or your training or your knowledge base of your character, is the thing that will make that, you know, kind of give you a nice a middle ground between dice do and everything. Yeah, because it really seems there's a lot of emphasis on that. It kind of breaks down. Just from, you know, kind of going through things, it breaks down what each profession kind of does and what it can expect, and also kind of how they would be affected by the doubt and hallucination of madness. Yeah.
Cool.
So it's quite interesting. So I think it's worth checking out, and hopefully we'll have a version of this. Yeah, right. We'll have a version of this in English. So, you know, it can be machine translated pretty easily, and it's not a huge tome.
Okay.
From the original Swedish, of course, much easier than Japanese. And that must have been quite a task. And they said that the original creator was involved in the translation process of it to kind of make sure that things were clear. So some things that maybe didn't translate well into Japanese, they just simplified them or made some kind of refining. Refining so that it worked for a Japanese speaking audience. So nice, some more Cthulhu for Japan.
Cool.
All right. So that'll do it for this week. So where can people find you?
On Twitter, as always, that's Hivemind, HYVEMYND, where I'm working on a Pokemon card game for my kid.
All right.
Which, after I figured it out, might actually work as that Mathronauts game that I was developing before. Uh-huh. Because basically it's just roll a number of dice, total them up. Is it bigger or smaller than a required number to catch this Pokemon?
Mm-hmm.
Which I couldn't figure out, like, the probabilities for that little Mathronauts game, or even if it was a game. Now, as opposed to like just like a learning tool, right?
Right, right.
Now I think I have something.
Oh, nice. So,
cool.
Yeah. Excellent.
And how about you?
So I'm doing the single panel gag cartoon that I've always been doing for most of my life. And you can find that at Abuse Cartoons on social media and both on YouTube and Twitch, where I do a live stream every Monday evening, North American time, of the drawing of that cartoon, the archive of which you can see at gocomics.com/domesticabuse. And if you want to support what we're doing here on the weekly, become a weakling.
Yes.
You can visit patreon.com/upturntable. And we've got a lot of different levels to support lore series or things that we're doing with the weekly or all sorts of things. The upturntable.com is the main website for everything that we're doing. And you can also, so all social media is upturntable. So, and the podcast as well. So the audio for this live stream goes out as the RSS feed for our Patreon. So you can hear everything we're saying.
Oh my God, I'm sorry.
and a little bit cleaned up. We sweeten the audio a little bit so it's a nicer audio experience. And what goes out regularly on the regular podcast stream is just from our hello to goodbye. So we don't cover any of the chat or anything on that. So if you want to hear any of that, either become a patron or you can become a member of the YouTube channel by clicking that join button below.
Yeah.
And and that'll also unlock all sorts of little things, emojis and things you can put into chat. So we know who you are. So please give us a like on this stream to help it be more visible, and subscribe if you want to be notified when we go live.
Like and subscribe.
Never
going to get old.
I was a teenager. All right. So that's it for this week. We'll be back next week.
Later, mortals.
Goodbye.